You have all these Republicans that, you know, claim that they were supporting free trade and immigration and all these other things for so long. And then all of a sudden, you know, they completely believe a different set of facts. Have they actually been exposed to a different reality? No, they just have a different motive and they want to believe a very different narrative.
One thing that's like super horrifying to me, I have a 15-year-old son, and the idea that, you know, in a few years, he might be a junior or senior in high school where like a teacher might be teaching him that there were genuine concerns about the validity of the 2020 election. That was like a seriously contested thing.
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks a lot for joining me today. This is Francis Fukuyama. A lot of you guys know him as the popular author of the popular book, The End of History. I believe you have a new book coming out pretty soon. And then you have a Substack that you write on that I'm linking in chat that is called the... Do you have a formal name for it, or do you just call it the Frankly Fukuyama?
Yeah, it's just called Frankly Fukuyama, and it's also a YouTube channel.
Yep, YouTube channel and a podcast as well. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
One of the things I watched recently was, do you remember a conversation you had with Tim Miller like about 5 months ago?
Yeah.
You guys were, yeah. One thing that we talk about a lot in my audience that I'm kind of curious to hear you speak a little bit more on is there's this feeling in politics. I'm 38 years old. There's this feeling in politics that like everything is horrible and it's never been this bad before. But I know that, especially now as I've gotten a bit older, sometimes we have that very recent feeling of like, well, you know, everybody's always thought it's as bad as it ever is going to be. And every new generation has that. And it's probably not that unique. But you engage in like a form of analysis that I appreciate where you try to point out, well, you know, is it actually uniquely bad? What would be a uniquely bad factor? And one of the factors that we have today that you point out that I've been talking about for a long time is this social media world where people can get in these totally separated realities because of how much is put in front of somebody.
Yeah. I think with the invention of the internet, we are able to live in these completely imaginary virtual worlds that really don't have to correspond to reality at all. And I think that's part of the problem with our politics right now is that we're living in these very bespoke realities that are disconnected from one another and disconnected from what's actually happening in the world.
I'm kind of curious, especially now with so much stuff happening on the planet that is like the political views are kind of bleeding into everything. Like you have to have an opinion on vaccines and working out and food. Like every single subject area of your life is now politically kind of tainted. More than in the past, I've heard people talk about like friends that are doctors, their family members will tell them, you know, like, I don't trust your profession, or people will be engineers or architects and their family will tell them they don't believe it. Like these very like basic, you know, facts about society or reality or anything related to the government or the establishment. In your personal life, do you have people that, I guess, like argue with you about a lot of political theory, or do you feel like you lose people who are living in these different kind of realities, despite, you know, how much influence or persuasion you kind of have in this kind of like, I guess, political theory world?
Not in the political theory world, but I have personal friends that I'm quite close to that, just perceive a very different reality from what I do. I have to say it was absolutely the worst during the COVID pandemic when everybody was on, you know, edge to begin with. And, what was reality was really contested at that point. Things have calmed down a little bit since then. But yeah, I definitely do have people that it's very hard to connect with because we don't share the same view of empirical reality.
Do you find that one frustrating thing for me is that, like, I do a lot of debate online. That's kind of my reputation is I do a lot of research. I argue a subject with people. But despite that, like, I get a ton of emails or questions from fans who will ask me, you know, like, I've got a friend who started watching Candace Owens. Like, how can I pull them out of this rabbit hole? Or, you know, I'm afraid of my parents are, you know, getting super anti-vax or anti-healthcare or whatever else. And, you know, my parents are ride or die Trump supporters. And I've had friends in my own life who, when they start watching this stuff, like the joke I always say is that if somebody asks me a question about like a Joe Rogan podcast or a Candace Owens podcast episode, that in 6 months they're gone. And it's like unstoppable. Have you seen anything on like a personal level, I guess, for how you can persuade people back? Or I guess, like, what is your feeling? It feels like it just, there's like this overwhelming feeling that once these people start down this rabbit hole, it's like impossible to pull them back from it, even if they're not fully inside of it yet.
Yeah, I know that that's true with a lot of people. I've heard individual stories of people that eventually came around. But I'm not sure that there's a consistent theory as to, you know, what makes people actually finally persuadable. But yeah, I have a friend that was down that rabbit hole and just woke up one day and realized that, you know, what he had been saying for the past couple of years was just a lot of BS. But I you know, what you'd like to think is that reality eventually catches up with people that are saying things that are simply not true. I mean, the biggest case of that would be with vaccine denialism, where don't get the vaccine because you think it's actually poisonous, and then you die of COVID because you didn't take the vaccine. And there have been a lot of cases like that, but, you know, even that has not been sufficient to convince people that, you know, they're believing a really false narrative. And I just find that very, very strange. I think that at some point that has to kick in. You know, the people that supported Hitler, a lot of them remained very convinced right up until the very end. And then they saw, you know, Berlin completely flattened by the Allies and everybody living in poverty and their friends dying. That's kind of an extreme case, but I think that that's kind of what it took to finally convince people that this that Hitler was not the greatest thing since sliced bread.
One thing that's kind of scary to me on that subject is I feel like there are certain lies that you can tell that will be very quickly corrected because you just come into conflict with reality, you know, too quickly. Like an example I'll give is if I tell somebody that I can fly, you know, if I jump off my balcony, that I can dispel that myth in 2 seconds, right? As long as it takes for me to hit the ground. But I feel like there's two things at play with the whole internet existence now. One is that the lies can be very far away from us, you know, geographically or in time. So, you know, I'll talk about the illegal immigration thing. Trump told us initially there were 15 million illegals that came under Biden, then it was 20 million, then 25, and then 30 million. At the end of the day, you know, who knows, actually? It could, like Trump has said, there have been zero illegal immigrants that have come in over the past year and a half. There's just no way that's true. It hasn't actually been zero. But like that's like a type of lie where I feel like you're never going to run into conflict with reality, even though some people think they do. I know a guy told me once, I see illegal immigrants, you know, all the time when I'm driving to work. And I asked the guy, I was like, how do you know they're illegal immigrants? And he had no answer. He's like, hadn't even considered the, you know, how to answer that question. It feels like with the internet, yeah, the lies get further and further and further away from us. When did these ever come back into reality?
You know, Jonathan Haidt wrote this book called The Righteous Mind 2-3 years ago, which I think is both depressing but also undoubtedly true. You know, he says that human rationality is not what we classically think of it, where people gather empirical information, they deduce certain facts or principles from that information, and they try to verify it, and that's what they believe. You know, what he argues is that in a majority of cases, people actually have a certain conclusion that they want, that they deeply believe in, and they use all of their enormous cognitive power to shape the facts to support that pre-existing conclusion and not to draw, you know, an independent judgment from it. And as you watch American politics, you know, you got to believe that that's the case. You know, you have all these Republicans that, you know, claim that they were supporting free trade and immigration and all these other things for so long. And then all of a sudden, you know, they completely believe a different set of facts. Have they actually been exposed to a different reality? No. They just have a different motive and they want to believe a very different narrative. And I think that is, you know, really the mechanism that flips them. And, you know, for somebody like me who has this naive enlightenment view that people are rational and they'll respond to information, it's very depressing because I think the truth of the matter is they don't.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I was curious, when you were talking to Tim Miller, you had the suggestion for like a middleware concept where you could have something that would interface basically between people and the social media that they would consume online. And I guess my question is, I feel like that kind of presupposes a person who genuinely wants to receive true information and not just information that makes them feel good. Do you feel like that would still be a thing that somebody would choose, that if they had the levers on the middle wire, or do you think, they would just opt for the echo chambers?
Such software actually does exist. There's a outfit called NewsGuard that actually will rate news sources in terms of their credibility. And actually, the science fiction, the cyberpunk writer Neal Stephenson, in one of his recent novels, had this world 17 years in the future where rich people paid for a service to add credibility to the stuff that they saw on the internet, because so much of it is just complete garbage. But I think that that's always going to be kind of an elite thing, that there'll be a very narrow circle of people that actually care about getting accurate information, and the rest of us will just believe what we want to believe. That was a hope I had, that people would actually, it may not be a question of individuals, maybe more a question of institutions. So for example, you could have a consortium of universities and colleges that would create one of these filters that would add to the credibility of news sources. And, the college could say, okay, if you're writing a paper, you have to use, this filter that will give you better quality information. So I think there are ways that you could introduce this into the society. But whether people would voluntarily do that, I'm not sure. The other thing is, I'm sure you'll also get alternative sources that will give you bad information, and people will pay for that as well because they want to believe certain things. And they'll even pay for that bad information.
Yeah, I'm kind of reminded of especially during the COVID time. I agree that was probably the worst time for misinformation. This concept of preprints, started to become popular, which was a cool idea, the idea that you could get access to information kind of early before it was officially published. But eventually all of the kind of crazy COVID people started relying on, I don't remember, it's called Medivir or whatever. There's a site online where you can publish these preprints, and all of the arguments in favor of ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine to cure every disease started to show up on these servers. And you run into this frustrating world where, people will have fact checkers, or they'll have these kind of like institutional safeguards. But then as soon as, like you said, when they're not giving people the information they want, for some reason, because they're not getting what they want from them, they start to distrust them. So it's very crazy to me that like Republicans or conservatives, I guess, don't see the irony right now in that they accuse everybody that calls himself like a fact checker. Like that's seen as a left-wing biased term if you're engaged in any kind of fact-checking stuff, which is why Facebook had to toss it because they felt it had become too politically tainted, or that peer-reviewed journals aren't to be trusted anymore. But if there's one rogue doctor with one preprint, N=6 study, this is like the most reputable source in the world. It's very frustrating to deal with these like alternate sources of knowledge that everybody seems to set up or establish for themselves.
Yeah, I think that people also are lazy. We would like to think that concerned citizens feel a civic responsibility to verify facts and look at alternative sources and come to their own judgment about the accuracy of things. But, who has time to do that? And so I think what we do is we just believe certain sources that we think are authoritative, and that relieves us of the duty of, you have no choice because there's so much information out there. So nobody is really going to, spend all that time trying to verify things. And so what you have is a hierarchy of authorities, and people will choose to believe, certain ones rather than others. And that doesn't, of course, guarantee that any of those authorities are actually going to be accurate.
Do you think that over the past, decade or so, I feel like, recentism, but I feel like when Trump was elected, this is when things started to really accelerate into crazy land. Do you think that over the past decade, academia, or I don't know if you could say liberal institutions in general, or people in the media could have taken different steps to kind of fight the wave of distrust that I guess populists kind of fomented about institutional anything, healthcare, government, everything else? Like, what do you think were like the big mistakes that the liberal institutions kind of made, and what could they have done differently?
I'm not sure that they could have done much differently. I'll just give you an example of my own institution, Stanford. Mm-hmm. After the 2016 election, before the 2020 election, we created something called the Stanford Internet Institute, or I'm sorry, the Stanford Internet Observatory that was going to try to keep track of misinformation. So they looked a lot at vaccine and misinformation, election denialism, this sort of thing. I'm sorry, this was after the 2020 election. And, you know, they had a lot of very serious academic researchers that were tracing, where narratives came from. They went back and looked at the origin of a lot of the misinformation that was out there. But this got completely sucked into, the polarization in Congress. And so, Comer's committee, called them on the carpet and accused them of themselves manufacturing fake information. You had also certain journalists, Michael Schallenberger. I don't know. He's not a journalist. I don't know what sure. he is. But Michael Schallenberger and Matt Taibbi, they just saw this as an opportunity to make a name for themselves by calling out this liberal institution and accusing it of censorship, which was ridiculous. And I think that in the end, Stanford gave in because they spent several million dollars defending themselves legally against these charges, but they just decided it wasn't worth the trouble. And so, that Internet Observatory closed down as a result. And I think, it was an effort to fight back. It was an effort to actually tell people, don't believe certain of the things you're seeing on the Internet. And it simply didn't work. Uh-huh. People continue to believe that, and the credibility of the fact checkers was challenged, and people just had no stable point of reference by which to judge any of this.
Do you think there's an effective way to communicate to people that some degree of like gatekeeping or some degree of some type of authoritative source is actually a good thing? Or is that it always like it feels people will attack that on the populist side from a liberal perspective? Well, they'll say things like, well, we need unlimited freedom of speech and unlimited right to choose our sources and do journalistic work. But then at the end of the day, like I feel like the environment has been severely degraded as a result of that idea that all sources are equal and there are no gatekeepers of knowledge. Is there an effective way to signal that like gatekeeping on some of this knowledge is actually a good thing and maybe contributes to an even better, liberal environment? Or do you not agree with that at all? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure that you can really communicate that. I mean, I'm not sure that there is an argument that you'll make that'll convince people. I think that if you look, for example, in the financial world, there are certain sources of financial information that are credible, and there's others that are not. And, if you make investment decisions based on the people that are trying to scam you, you're going to lose a lot of money. And so there's actually a kind of built-in incentive to, take the highest quality information in that kind of narrow space. And I think that's really what protects you there, where you've got a clear self-interest in getting good information, that you can make decisions based on. When it comes to politics in general, more general kinds of facts, I'm not sure that the consequences of absorbing bad information are so immediately evident, and therefore you don't have the same incentive to go after really credible sources. Although I guess I'm a little bit impressed with the way that deep fakes have been in a certain sense taken into account. So on my Instagram account, I would say that now 80% of the videos I see are deep fakes. And I think that, it's a problem because you really don't know when something is for real or not. But I also think that most people also think that they're deep fakes, and there's a lot of skepticism about, especially since this Iran war started, everything is fake video. And I'm not sure that people believe it. Now, that puts us in a slightly different position where we're not being manipulated to believe certain specific untrue things, but we're now moving to a space where we think nothing is true. Everything you see is being manipulated, and therefore we can't really rely on, anything. And I think it's going to have big consequences. So you think about a courtroom, where you're trying somebody for murder or fraud or some, serious crime, if you had a video or a photo of them, let's say, taking bribe money, you know, 20 years ago, it would have been enough to put them in jail. But these days, it's so easy to fake that kind of evidence. And so I think the courts are now adjusting to the fact that, you know, we used to call it photographic evidence, but there is no such thing as photographic evidence, really, since the invention of Photoshop. And I think that that's going to be a big problem in even institutions like the legal system trying to cope with this flood of disinformation. And that's not going to be good for any of us.
Do you think that we're on a path right now for this to improve in the future, or do you only see the environment getting worse and worse?
I think that, you know, people are trying, the technologists are trying to fight back. And so there have been various efforts to, for example, establish a chain of custody system, you know, with photographs where you can actually see who had possession of this digital image and, you know, how it moved from one source to another and where it might have been manipulated. I don't know whether, you know, in the end, technically, you can actually do something like that. But I do think that there are people that are trying to come up with technical solutions to this. But I have no idea whether in the end that kind of thing is going to work. It may work for very high, you know, if you think about signatures and notaries, you know, for legal documents, we actually have a very specialized system to ensure the credibility. So if somebody signs a $100 million contract, you know, you got a system in place to make sure it's really them signing it and agreeing to the contract. So I suspect that, you know, we're probably going to devise authentication systems for really important stuff. But, you know, the massive information we get over the internet is not that important, and nobody's going to spend the time to authenticate, you know, at that level.
Do you think outside of the, just like the AI deepfake, you know, generated video stuff, outside of that, for our broader, I guess, information landscape, do you think that, broadly speaking, is moving in a better direction, or something will happen that will move us in a better direction? Or do you see that as never improving, or information landscape is just degrading more and more, and it's just a new world we kind of have to deal with?
I honestly don't see any general movement towards, you know, higher quality information. You know, we're living in a world in which we got a president of the United States that basically almost every time he opens his mouth, he's saying something that is untrue, and that I don't know that he for certain knows that it's untrue, but he really doesn't care whether it's true or not. And, you know, when you have a person with that kind of authority speaking in that manner, I think it's very hard to, you know, really say that we need credible information and we need, you know, important authoritative people to give us credible information when, you know, it's not happening at that level.
If there, okay, this is getting pretty doomer. if there was a way that you could snap your fingers, if there was like a thing that you could change, like understanding there might be issues with things. Like I have a lot of conversations about like, what would I change? And I understand that whatever you change, there would be obviously a lot of speed bumps. Like, I think there should be more stringent controls over disinformation online, but people obviously bring up that, well, you know, who's going to censor the misinformation and who's going to decide? And my response is usually, I'm not sure, you know, it would be an imperfect process, but whatever that would be, it would be vastly improved to the environment that we live in right now. Because right now it feels almost as bad as it possibly could be. Almost. I mean, I'm sure it could always get worse. Are there any big changes that you think could be made theoretically if you could snap your fingers? Like, do you think that all social media journalistic news stuff should just be deleted, or like, what would be, you know, good steps in a positive direction?
You know, I think the solution may not be the kind of thing where you could snap your fingers and, you know, there's this one change that affects things. I think that part of our problem right now is actually in people, that you've got a large number of people that either think they can enrich themselves, or more importantly, gain power by saying stuff that isn't true, you know, by saying things that are completely toxic. And I could imagine, you know, coming to a point where people in general just get so sick of this kind of, you know, complete disregard for truth, for evidence, for, you know, credibility, that, you know, you'll just elect a different, you know, class of people who have a bigger stake in saying things that are actually, you know, much more credible. And that will change the culture. I don't know if culture is downstream from politics or politics is downstream from culture, but I do think the two are interrelated. And I could imagine a political world in which you could reestablish some of the authorities that we used to have because powerful people believe in them, and they believe in, you know, authorities that are actually authoritative.
Yeah, I would hope so. I think speaking to the kind of the invisibility or how far removed things are, it's kind of annoying that there are so many bad things that can happen, but it's very hard for the average person, or even me, you know, I try to read on these issues. Like when somebody says that we're defunding all of the research in academia across the United States, like, I mean, I really don't know what that means, or I don't know what it would look like. I mean, I can guess, but it's really hard to have a tangible feeling about that, especially when the consequences can be so far downstream. You know, it might be 5, 10, 15 years before we really start to feel the effects of these types of activities. Do you think that, like, when you, I'm assuming you're more favorable to the left right now than the conservative movement in the United States, just based on everything I've heard you say. When you look at Donald Trump on the right, do you think that it was inevitable that the right would produce a figure like this more than the left would, or do you think that they just got lucky or unlucky? Do you think there's a reason why the conservative movement was more predisposed towards a Trump-like figure than the left? Or do you think there's like an equal chance that it could happen on the left?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. So I'm going to have to give you a kind of weaselly answer. I think it's actually a combination both of sort of underlying social conditions that laid the ground for this, and then some particular just personalities and bad luck. So in the latter category, you know, Trump is basically a genius. There's no question. I mean, we've not seen a person like this in American politics, you know, in generations, where you have somebody that has such a good sense for popular resentments and things, narratives that are going to work, you know, with great masses of people, and that can talk to, you know, ordinary Americans in a way that's credible, that nobody else has really thought of before. And so that part of it, I think, is kind of unique. I don't see any other, you know, a lot of people are trying to imitate him, but I don't see any kind of major politicians that are likely to succeed him that are going to have his skill in doing it. On the other hand, there are these, what a social scientist calls structural conditions, meaning there are things that are embedded in the larger trends in society or not due to just individuals, that I think are facilitating this. So one we've talked about already is technology. You know, it was the case that when you had only two or three national newspapers and two or three big TV channels, it was much, much easier to control information. It wasn't always good information, but, you know, people really didn't have much choice in terms of what they could listen to and believe, and therefore, you know, they all tended to, the range of things they believed was much smaller and much more under control. So that's one thing. I think the other part that's harder to understand and interpret is the social part of it, because a lot of people felt left out, they felt disrespected, they felt, you know, angry at the existing system. And that's something that accumulated over time, and I think has driven a lot of the refusal to accept the word of elites on all sorts of subjects. And when you put all of those factors together, right, brilliant demagogue, changing technology, and accumulating social resentments, they all sort of come together into the world that we have today. And you can imagine a future world in which, you know, you don't have the demagogic leader, you have technologies that maybe, you know, are more susceptible to more elite control, and you have people not feeling quite so resentful. So that's why I'm saying this is a kind of mealy-mouth answer to your question, because I just think that the stuff we're seeing now is a product of a lot of things coming together that, you know, will not always be together.
If you had to think like historically in the U.S., or maybe even around the world, I guess, would you consider there to be like a kind of like a golden information age where you would consider like this is the peak amount of access that people have had to institutions to work with them to publish stuff, but this is the peak amount of access that you know, readers had or recipients of technologies have had or companies or engineers have had to engage with research? Like, is there like a, and then like in terms of like being able to publish media to the public and for it to be true but for a lot of people to engage with both the reading and the writing of it, do you think there's like a peak kind of information age that has existed, or do you think it was like the printing press and then it all went downhill from there?
Well, I think that before the 21st century, we had developed a pretty good system for you know, I guess one of the big problems is that Americans in a democratic society don't like the idea of hierarchies. But in fact, we had a lot of hierarchies in place, right? There's a legal hierarchy, there's an academic hierarchy, there's a scientific hierarchy. All of these hierarchies had certain methods for sorting information. So in a court, even today, a lawyer cannot just get up and start spewing a lot of nonsensical facts. The judge is going to say, not only, you know, be quiet and sit down, but the judge can actually sanction the attorney for spreading disinformation, right? And I think it's still the case in the scientific world that there's a kind of self-policing that goes on. So there's a lot of scientific fraud that we've become aware of, but there's also mechanisms for exposing scientific fraud. And I think that that mechanism that exists in that scientific hierarchy is still largely in place. You can't just say, you know, total nonsense in a scientific peer-reviewed journal, even if, you know, some people outside the system will question it. So I think that that stuff still exists. The trouble is it's all been eroded, or journalism is another case, right? That you had this old journalistic norm that you had to have at least two sources before you could actually publish an assertion about something that happened in the world. And so all of these hierarchies have seen their authority being questioned, and they've seen that authority, you know, diminish. But I think it's still there in many respects. And as I said, there's actually an incentive for people to want to have good information. And therefore, there will always be a market for, you know, a hierarchy that can actually filter out, you know, stuff that's bad. I think, however, that it really was the internet that just dumped all this crap on us, you know, because essentially anyone could say anything they wanted. We thought at first that this was going to be great and that the marketplace of ideas would sort this all out in the end. And it turns out that was just wrong. It doesn't sort things out. It just leaves you swimming in crap.
Yeah, I feel like you brought up earlier that financial stuff, you know, will get figured out very quickly because people are putting real money behind, you know, whatever the decisions being made are. So you can actually very quickly test a thing that somebody's saying. But it seems like for so much other stuff, as stuff has become more kind of like nationalized, internationalized, when I read something online, I mean, it's just so hard to know, or you can't really know anything about what's true or not true. I mean, that was always true to some extent, but now the important issues to us are getting further and further away. You know, did 30,000 Palestinians die? Was it 500,000 Palestinians? Was it, you know, what's happening between Russia and Ukraine? As the issues get further away, it becomes easier and easier to just never actually verify a fact of the matter. One thing that's like super horrifying to me, I have a 15-year-old son, and the idea that, you know, in a few years, he might be a junior or senior in high school where like a teacher might be teaching him that there were genuine concerns about the validity of the 2020 election, that was like a seriously contested thing. And there's just so much, you know, information hierarchy, as you say, courts that went through all this information. And that's just, it just wasn't seriously ever questioned. There was no serious contention there. Or the same thing, you know, with, you know, I saw Alex Jones go on Joe Rogan and he said this thing about like, you know, well, look at the conspiracy theories. And then Joe Rogan was like, well, it looks like a lot of them turned out to be right. And when you look at it, that's just not true. Almost all the conspiracy theories turned out to be incorrect about COVID and the vaccines and everything else. but people still believe the exact opposite, where I call this the all roads lead to Rome fallacy, where even if the thing you expect doesn't come true, there's like a reason why it didn't, and that reinforces the conspiracy that you had even more. So it becomes impossible. Like, people without the vaccine are getting sicker than people with the vaccine. And I've seen people promote this idea that, well, if you got vaccinated, you're actually shedding the virus onto people around you, and the vaccine that you're getting is harming others. And it's like, there's like no way to rein in the misunderstandings. And yeah, it's so frustrating.
Yeah, that's true. I think a lot of that ends up, you know, kind of chaotic, where people just don't know what to think. The horrifying future that I could imagine is a little bit different, where it's a little bit more systematic. I wrote a piece for the New York Times a few months ago about this, where I was imagining my grandkids going to high school sometime in the middle of the 20th century, where they open up their textbooks and they say, well, you know, the United States fought this bloody war that killed 600,000 Americans over a nonsense issue, which was slavery, because actually slaves were not being mistreated. It was actually a benign system that a bunch of northern radicals got everybody stirred up and, you know, led to this really disastrous war. The same thing was true of World War II. This was just a little spat between Germany and France that got blown out of proportion by a warmonger named Franklin D. Roosevelt and Winston Churchill. And, you know, this led to, again, millions of people dying in a, you know, totally fake cause. And you just have this completely different narrative about the history of the last two centuries that, you know, basically turns black into white and white into black in terms of our moral judgments about things. And that, it seems to me, is kind of conceivable, that something like that actually could, you know, could happen. A lot of it depends on power, because, you know, that's one thing that people with power do, is they try to shape the narrative of these grand historical narratives about, you know, how we got to where we are today. And that, I think, is, you know, in a way, a scarier situation than simply a chaotic one when nobody knows, you know, really. Well, I don't know. That's something we ought to talk about. Which of these is worse? Mm-hmm. If really nobody has a master narrative, or, you know, the master narrative is deeply wrong and badly intentioned, and yet, you know, many people believe it because the people in power tell you to believe it.
Yeah, I thought you were going somewhere else with that fear, and you were going to cap that off with, you know, it was a popular debate a few months ago, and it's still kind of, you know, bubbling under the surface, where there was this guy called Ian Carroll making the rounds on all these shows with Joe Rogan. And that essentially was the argument, that Churchill was this massive warmonger, yeah, and the United States got involved in World War II for not the greatest reasons. And, you know, like, they say the Holocaust was bad, but have you seen the bombings in Dresden? Like, we did all the same things. And, you know, and yeah, you run through, well, and even the slavery arguments, those have been popular in America for a long time, that it was a states' rights issue. I've seen people make the argument that, you know, well, the black people in America today are better off than they would have been if we would have left them in Africa. So actually, you know, it's better that we did slavery and they weren't all treated horribly. And before civil rights, black people were happier. And yeah, I hear these arguments that are just given so much, in all the annoying ways that I'm sure you've heard, where they're not really given that strongly. It's just people asking questions about them, even though they never seem to get to any answers about it, or do like even rudimentary research into it. I'm curious, you're kind of like broadly like the liberal guy, you know, I've watched you. It's very rare to see like people that are supportive of just like liberalism, you know, that don't eventually either bend to the right or become like, I guess, like leftist socialist tankies. When you look at the information landscape that exists today, is there any part of you that ever wonders, like, maybe liberalism can't be the final form? Maybe it does need to be some kind of more authoritarian form of government that can have more stringent controls on misinformation, because the West just can't survive this deluge of trash that exists on the internet?
Yeah, definitely. I have a memoir coming out in September where I talk about some of these issues, like, is liberalism self-contradictory at its core? You know, that certain liberal principles just can't be sustained over time. So one is what you mentioned, that you might not be able to see your way out of this information morass. Another one that I think is a big problem really has to do with the rule of law. So liberalism is basically about the rule of law. We want to put constraints on power so that powerful people can't just do whatever they want. They have to act according to law. You have constitutional checks and balances that prevent a president from doing whatever he wants. And one of the tendencies in liberalism is both to multiply, you know, voices in the public sphere, but the other thing is to multiply rules to the point where you have so many rules that you really paralyze from coming to any kind of, you know, decisive collective action, and you need to do that. And I think that the populism actually, in a way, comes out of this, that people see this chaos, cacophony of ideas, and they don't see a authoritative master narrative, and they see a society that's unable to build things, that's unable to come to big collective decisions. And, you know, that's what drives the demand for a strong man who just cuts through all this crap that, you know, all these rules and constraints, and really, you know, just gets things done. And I think, you know, quite frankly, we're seeing that right now. I mean, that's what people like about Donald Trump and Elon Musk. You know, they're builders that have faced this liberal morass of constraints, and they're trying to do something about it. And they appreciate the fact that they're acting beyond the law. I have this little hobby horse about vigilante movies, because there's a lot of them out there. You know, if you look at Denzel Washington's three Equalizer movies, that's what they're all about. You know, that there are these bad people running around. The authorities can't do anything about them to really punish them. And so you have this guy that's really good at killing people, but has good intentions, who acts like an avenging angel to, you know, right all of the wrongs of society. And I have to say, when I watch these movies, I'm rooting for him. So, you know, God damn it, I want you to kill all those Russian mobsters that are tormenting this, you know, this poor woman. And I think that, you know, that's kind of where a lot of our politics is right now, that the liberalism has put a few too many constraints on the ability of a state to act, on the ability of a society to make collective decisions. And that then triggers the opposite reaction where, you know, somebody says, well, let's just forget about all the rules and just have a strong man, you know, make all the decisions for us. And that's where I think a lot of our politics, unfortunately, is heading. And what we don't have is somebody that says, no, we want to make big decisions. We want to be able to do stuff together, but we do want to do it in a legal fashion. We want to make sure that we've got consensus and, you know, people have bought in. And that's what I don't see in our politics right now.
It's very funny that you bring this up, because I had a really big argument a couple months ago, where there's this big argument on the left over how accountable do we need to hold the Trump administration, you know, going forward. And I kind of use this whole example of, like, you know, you have a system and it works, and a system that's working, you have these heroes that come and they save the day. But sometimes there's a perception that the system can be sometimes too much of a restraint, or there are people abusing the system. So then this concept of, like, an anti-hero gets introduced, where they're here to, like, save the system, but they're very clearly doing things that conventional good guys wouldn't. So they have to work outside the system to do it. But the big fear is that in media, the anti-hero is usually, he's an anti-hero, not a villain. So he's always reintegrated somehow back into the society at the end. So either he dies, or he, you know, goes into the forest and becomes a lumberjack, you know, like Dexter, or something happens to remove him from the equation. But then in the real world, you know, obviously going down that pathway of anti-hero vigilantism is prone to kind of more authoritarian belief, you know, in and of itself, and you kind of lose yourself in that game. Kind of on this, I guess, on this train of thought, one thing that's been frustrating to me, like looking at like broad liberal thought, is I kind of wonder sometimes like how many people really truly value like the liberal process of thought versus how many people say they do, but that's like a proxy for just the results that they agree with. Like, you know, somebody will say like, oh,
wow, that's a good question.
Yeah. Do you think that's like uniquely different now versus in the past, or do you think we've always kind of been like that? Or yeah,
we've always been like that. So liberalism, the weakness of liberalism is that it doesn't, in a sense, have a core. You know, you've got these procedures that allow people to live together peacefully, and you can value the fact that you live in a rule of law society, but it doesn't stir up the same kind of emotional investment that, you know, everybody marching to a deep sense of shared values, you know, produces. So people, you know, they, if you've lived in an authoritarian system, you really value freedom. You really want to be able to do whatever the hell you do. But at a certain point, if you live in that kind of society where you can do whatever the hell you want, you begin to say to yourself, well, okay, but is that enough? You know, I am free to do bad things and good things, and we really don't seem to have any priority of the good things over the bad things. I don't, you know, particularly like that society. It may make me safe and it may make me prosperous, but I don't feel like I have much in common with my neighbors or my fellow countrymen. And, you know, I wish there was more that bound us together in a community. And I think that that's also, it's not something new. I think that was one of the big criticisms of liberalism, you know, from the, you know, so if you look historically, liberalism begins in the European wars of religion, where everybody is killing each other over whether they're Protestant or Catholic for 150 years. They all get tired of it. And they say, let's just put religion to the side. Let's live in peace under a rule of law. Nobody can impose their religion on anybody else. But then as time goes on, you know, people begin to say, yeah, but, you know, there has to be something more to life than just tolerating your neighbor who you hate, actually, whose ideas you really hate. You know, there's got to be something that binds us together more strongly. And so you get these waves of anti-liberal feeling where, you know, you say, no, there has to be a dominant idea that really holds us together. That then leads to violence, to conflict, to aggression. And then people fall back to the liberalism that, you know, keeps them safe and so forth. But safetyism, I think, by itself is not an inspiring, you know, cause. We may want safetyism if we're constantly threatened and in danger, but, you know, it's not an inspiring way of life.
Yeah, this is a big problem that I have when it comes to debates or just having arguments in general over policy stuff. I'm a pretty big, like, I like to have my freedom to do what I want to do, and that's just like how I enjoy living my life. But I've noticed increasingly that for a lot of people, there does seem to be the requirement to have kind of something more pushing you in a certain direction, that like having some greater purpose or some unifying thing is really important to a lot of people. And it's very frustrating because it feels like, especially in the aftermath of the Cold War, once you lose your major opposition to define yourself towards, you kind of become, like your ideology just fades into the background, and it's just kind of the default assumption. And then everybody's looking at like, what's the next thing? What are we going to do? What is our political ideology? And it's like, well, we have like liberalism. It's like, I don't even know what that is. That's just like the status quo. Like, it's time for something new. And that's what we're all fighting over now. And then it becomes very frustrating because I'm reminded in 2016 of Hillary Clinton's campaign slogan, which I agreed with, but I guess it's stupid. But Trump, you know, had this like, we need to make America great again. And it was always funny to ask people, what year would you want to go back to? Like, what do you want to improve? And Hillary had this idea of like, well, America's already great, which is true, but it didn't speak to the feelings, I guess, that people had. And it's annoying that these people can ride off of all of the accomplishments and achievements of a broadly liberal society and then kind of build on that the most anti-liberal authoritarian style of governance or, you know, ideas that they can off the back of, like, all the liberal accomplishments.
Yeah, no, that's right. I think that if you ask yourself, what in contemporary America would you be willing to die for? It's hard to answer that question for most people because they've achieved a kind of, you know, good society. It's reasonably fair and equal and open and tolerant and so forth. But, you know, would you really die to live as an American in the year 2026? And I don't think a lot of people feel sufficiently inspired, you know, by that liberal agenda that they want to do that. And that's why they're attracted to causes for which people do die. Now, my answer to that is partly that, you know, there still is a remaining struggle against the enemies of liberty. If you really want to risk your life in you know, in a noble cause, you should probably go to Ukraine and volunteer to fight on the front lines where, you know, hundreds of thousands of people have actually sacrificed and risked their lives on behalf of wanting to live freely. But, you know, for most of us, we don't have that kind of a challenge, and we want that kind of a challenge. And I think that's one of the kind of intrinsic weaknesses of liberalism, that if it's successful, it doesn't provide us, you know, this higher plane that we can aspire to. It becomes kind of boring, and we feel frustrated that there's not a higher, you know, standard that we can live up to.
In academia, do you feel like is there a quiet upsetness, or is there some pushback coming to? There's like this Rolodex of, I'll say, questionable academics that are always making their rounds on every show. For me, like I'm not asking you to call out or attack anybody, but like I look at somebody like Mearsheimer, who will make a ton of predictions or say a ton of things that are all, in my mind, very conveniently pro-Russia every single time. And these same kind of like three or four academic figures are making the rounds on all these shows, giving their perspective on it. Is there at any point, do you feel like people in academia are talking about this or have a desire to go out and be more public and kind of push back on it? Or because it feels frustrating sometimes that all these incredibly knowledgeable people seem like they aren't throwing their hat into the ring to fight over these things in public. I understand it's not what they signed up for, but...
Yeah, I think that in general, the incentives in academia are to be super cautious. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not going to get tenure in a major university by acting the way John Mearsheimer's act. He had tenure already. So he didn't, you know, his position was safe and he could say whatever he wanted. But I think that, you know, the problem with most academics, I think, today is that they're too small bore. You know, their incentives are just to work on some really, really narrow issue and follow the methodology exactly. Don't take any risks with regard to subject matter, with regard to the way you approach, you know, your subject or your methodology. And that's why someone like Mearsheimer kind of stands out, because he's not willing to, you know, play by those rules.
Yeah, I find even personally, if I'm having a conversation with somebody or a debate with somebody, if I'm hedging on something that I'm not certain of, it's just always more rhetorically effective to stake a stronger position, even if you don't know what you're talking about, because people look to the authority that a person has on a position, and then they automatically trust that person more on it. And there's never any like fact checking or anything, or people live in totally different factual worlds anyway, so it doesn't matter, I guess. Yeah,
there's a lot of people whose careers have been built on that. My favorite example is Dinesh D'Souza, who I've known over several decades. Like, he was the editor of the Dartmouth Review when he was an undergraduate, and he came to prominence by saying, you know, really outlandish things that other conservatives weren't willing to say. And, you know, I think when you start your career that way, that's what you're then going to do. You're constantly going to search for the next outlandish thing that you can say that will get everybody talking. But the trouble is that you have to keep outdoing yourself. And so you work yourself into more and more, you know, ultimately unsupportable positions, just because you want to get that high of, you know, having challenged everybody and, you know, gotten attention for it. So, you know, that's true of, you know, the academics that go down that route. But I would say in general, my complaint about academics is not that they're too attention seeking. I would say that it's they're on the whole, you know, probably too cautious and therefore unwilling to try to address, you know, a lot of the bigger questions that we need to deal with.
I don't know if I misstated that, but that would be my frustration, is because it feels like there are just a few that are willing to go out and take such strong stances. And then it can be frustrating on my end of things, having to try to do all this reading and research when I know there is a person who knows everything about this topic. But as you said, the incentives just don't really align for somebody who's like carefully publishing scientific materials that he's prepared for other people to pour through in a very meticulous manner, to jump onto a 4-hour podcast to have a debate about the lost city of Atlantis, or whether or not the Van Allen belt is too hot to ever let us go to the moon, or something ridiculous. You know, these people argue all the time. Yeah. Okay, well, this has been a deeply demotivating conversation. I'm sorry. I know you feel similarly. Like, man, the information environment is so bad today. It's just, Jesus. You said you do a podcast at the, you said it was called the Frankie Fukuyama podcast.
Frankly Fukuyama, right.
Podcast, and then people can find your writing by Googling that, and I'll have those links in the chat.
Yeah, so
as well.
I helped start an online magazine called American Purpose, and that was absorbed into Persuasion, which is another online magazine that Yasha Monk created. So we're all kind of united in the same media space.
Okay. Well, I hope people check you guys out there. Like I said, I'll have links in the chat for that. Any final closing thoughts or anything? Otherwise,
I think that we're going to get out of this. You know, ultimately, I don't really see a way of doing this yet, but it does seem to me that human beings are incredibly adaptable, and you know, we've gone through periods of you know, technological and media, you know, chaos when it looked like, you know, all of the institutions were about to collapse. And I think that human beings have such a kind of pro-institutional instinct at base that they will kind of figure out ways to regularize their lives, because human beings are really uncomfortable by chaos. You know, they don't like not having norms. They don't like not having rules to follow. So I suspect that we will probably settle down in this respect in the long run.
Okay. That's an uplifting message to end on. I agree. I always try to sell positivity at the end of my audience. Otherwise, I wouldn't do what I do. So thank you so much. I appreciate the conversation.
All right. Thank you very much.